All right, this is Pure Decking for April the 17th, 2014. This is the show about stuff that interests me, like descending into a police state, information security, and creating panic scares. I'm Morps, and tonight we have Suave. What are you drinking, hey. Suave?
Water, once again.
Water. We have the Madman. What are you drinking, Madman?
Sierra Nevada Ruthless Rye.
Very nice. And we have Sard. Sard, what are you drinking?
I have, what is this? The, Mexican Dead Beer, their Pale Ale, Queen of the Night.
Cool. Cool.
It's not bad. Kind of different.
I am polishing off my bottle of, Devil's Cut. And had a lot more in the bottle than I thought I did, so that glass is very full.
We always say.
So by the, I'm sure I'll be sounding fantastic by the end of the show. So bit of show news, I guess rather important show news. I'm going to be putting Pure Decking on kind of a hiatus for at least a month, maybe two. I'm taking a new job and moving, and I don't know what my internet connection is going to be in the next couple of weeks. I don't know a lot of things just yet, and I know I'm going to have to do a lot of work to get up to speed with the new job. So that kind of takes priority. But I asked Sard, and Sard said he would be willing to try to do... Yeah, Psychros, you got it. It's because Madman said where I worked a couple of weeks ago, and I have to, you know, make a new identity, fake some paperwork, hack into the freaking Social Security system so I can change my number. Kidding. But Sard has said he's going to try to do some of the So you're going to try to do some decking, right?
Yeah, I'll give it a shot.
All right. You know, so. Nobody get too upset at him if it doesn't make it weekly. I know he's also real busy in his job, so... But, yeah. So, anyways, that's... And, ooh, actually, Sard, we need to talk about how people are going to run shows while I'm indisposed.
Yep.
So we need to get that sorted out as well.
Yeah, we definitely need to talk about that. Get it going.
Yeah. So, anyways, once I get all the dust settled and figure out my situation, get an apartment and all that happy horse shit, I'll be back and we'll be doing the show again. And don't anybody panic. It's still a security job. It's I've left my position in security to take up dance and.
Oh.
He just felt the music one day and has to mambo.
Can't stop mamboing.
He's up to number four. We won't let him do mambo number five.
Wow. Yeah, security for a bank, actually. So this is going to be...
Oh, so you're working with Madman. I suddenly see a bunch of computer problems in your future, Madman. That's weird. How did your account get locked out for the 57th time?
Different bank, but that's okay. And I'm sure Madman's going, shoo!
Like, oh, crap, I was going to spend like 6 hours getting paid for doing nothing.
I was thinking we need to make up some like fabricated story about how all banks are connected to the same network, and he's still going to be able to get you no matter what bank you work at.
That's not a fabricated story. It's how they do wire transfers.
There we go. See, no one's safe.
No, it's gonna be the policies that make every. It's like we've just passed a new password policy. You have to change your password every morning.
This applies to Madman.
This applies only to
Madman. Everyone else is fine. It's just Madman.
Rock on. First morning, it's Madman number one. Then Madman number two. Madman number three. How many characters long can a password be?
Sorry, you can't have any repeating characters ever.
There you go.
The keyboard starts to run out.
It's like, I've set my language to bet on the keyboard. I don't even know how to recognize any of these symbols.
Yeah, you just resorted to holding down Alt and using the number pad. And
hi, I've moved on to Sanskrit. They more use patterns of slashes and boxes than actual letters. So there's going to be some repeat characters, but that's only because 8 slashes in a box is 1 letter in this language.
Ooh, that would, no, but in terms of a password, that would actually be good, because you would end up with like a 64-character password, you know, to have a short password in that language, and that would be fantastic, because that would be really hard to crack. So
yeah,
you think you're being funny, but that would actually be a really good password if you could use those. The problem is a lot of systems won't let you use those characters. They freak out and they think you're trying to do SQL injection or something. I don't know. But
I was gonna say, good luck trying to find a dictionary in Sanskrit. I don't think it exists.
A complete one? Probably not. But it's the oldest language, so we still have it on record. I can't speak it, but somebody can read it.
All right. So let's go ahead and get into our discussion here. So I'm guessing nobody else noticed this, but Windows XP isn't getting patches anymore.
What? Madness.
I actually noticed that, thanks to a TV commercial.
Thanks to a TV commercial.
Are they trying to sell you antivirus?
Super Shield will start patching for Windows XP.
If you
install it on your computer, you won't get a virus, and it will keep your Windows up to date.
I doubt that it's going to keep your Windows up to date. I just think they're just going to... A lot of people are saying, oh, well, we're going to continue to support XP for however long. But so... Yeah, Microsoft is no longer supporting Windows XP. The 8th is when that actually stopped. I think we mentioned it on the last show, but it's worth actually talking about. Because nobody ever uses old, unsupported operating systems, right? I can't be the only guy still rocking the Commodore 64 every once in a while. Right, guys? Right?
Yeah, but that can't run a virus. So you're good.
That's true.
You would think
completely
that.
Completely different category.
There were viruses for the Commodore 64.
Yeah, but the difference is, like, those were cool viruses. Wow, that cat is angry.
One second.
Madman, what did you... Put the puppy down!
What was I going to say? Oh, the viruses in the Commodore 64 days were cool viruses. Like, they would, like, make your computer play music and, like, you know, fuck up your screen, give it artifacts or whatever. Like, play Star Wars theme song or something like that. It's not, you know...
Well, you had the cool
viruses.
Viruses
back in the day were cool, but nowadays all they do is steal your info and your bank account.
I had the one that you know, screwed up the alignment of your floppy drive so it would just chew up disks.
Ooh.
That would be kind of a nasty one. You know the one I'm talking about, right? I mean, like the old DOS viruses.
Yeah, some of those were fantastic. I mean, they were just
they were hilarious.
I mean,
yeah.
My favorite was the Coca-Cola virus. Anybody remember this one?
No.
The Coca-Cola virus was called this because it would pop up a message on your screen saying Coca-Cola is offering you a complimentary cup holder for your computer, and it would eject the CD-ROM.
See? Those are cool viruses. They're hilarious.
That is pretty cool.
And it wasn't much of a virus. Account, it didn't really spread. You kind of had to spread for it.
Yeah, that was back in the old sneakerware days where that's how you got most of your viruses, is the disk from your friend that, you know, wasn't running AV or something.
So I'm pretty sure most AV didn't even flag that thing, because all it did was pop open the CD drive. But still.
Pretty awesome.
We're going to have to turn that into an actual virus and have it just spread. All it does is throw an icon up. Cup holder.
Well, Madman, you remember Fedakin, right?
Yes.
So at one point in time back when we were all still doing WoW servers, he gave me SSH access to one of his boxes. And it was a box that I figured out where he kept it. It was on top of the entertainment center in his living room. So I wrote a bash script that would open and close the CD drive, you know, once a minute. I got a phone call, not from him, but from his wife at the time, who said, fucking quit it. She didn't have any clue that he had given me access to that machine or anything. She just assumed it was me.
That's hilarious.
The fact that she was right was notwithstanding. So, anyways, yeah. You know, everybody's saying, oh, XP is dead. And I saw somebody who had written a fantastic obituary for XP about its, you know, preceding deaths and surviving siblings. And, you know, Windows 8 has a mental problem, so won't be attending the funerals and won't be remembered by anybody. But the thing is, it's not dead. The IRS is paying Microsoft insane amount of money to continue to support it for another year. A lot of companies are paying Microsoft an insane amount of money to support it for another year. I had a story, I think we're hitting a little out of order here. No, it's not. Okay. On the Make Use Of has an interesting little article on what's happening with XP now that Microsoft has stopped. And they list out that you're going to get a monthly pop-up message. Now, you can check a little box and make it quit doing that, but it's just going to, if you don't, every month it's going to pop up saying, this operating system's not supported. You should give us more money and buy a new one. It will apparently still activate. So if you make a fresh install of XP, it'll still go activate with Microsoft and still work. Of course,
giving it away. That doesn't surprise me. They still want their fucking money.
Yeah, I guarantee they'll still... They will still prosecute somebody distributing it.
Oh, yeah.
So, of course, no patches or official fixes, but Microsoft is charging $200 per computer for what they are calling custom support. $200 a year for custom support, and they'll only give critical patches. They'll charge you extra for patches they consider important. And they're not even going to bother to produce anything below the whatever their important rating means. But it's
wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. I figured it was just all patches, you know, that they come out. I didn't know they had different tiered support like that.
Oh, you've never ran a WAS server, have you?
Yeah, I have. No, I mean, I thought the $200 got you everything.
No, it's only getting you the important patches. And, of course, it's really set up for business users because they expect you to buy it in bulk. But, you know, they're really not fooling around that they're not supporting this thing anymore. So, you know, but, and they've already broken something, too. Their last patch they pushed out. Let's see, the stories from hothardware.com. Hot on the heels of Microsoft's retirement of XP, users reporting some rather severe issues with their machines caused by the company's security program. While no data is at risk and the OS remains operable, if you get hit with the bug, you'll think you've got a virus. The PC will slow down to a crawl, as one Google Plus user has said. And further errors related to msmpeng.exe might also arise on boot. So apparently, even though they're supposed to be supporting security essentials through like at least the end of this year, are they doing next year? Did I see 2015 floating around somewhere for security essentials on XP?
I think so, yeah. I think it was supposed to be around for another year.
Well, apparently this last patch, they broke it. And they're not going to patch XP anymore, so are they going to fix this or not? I'm guessing not.
They're supporting security essentials, so you'd think if it's a bug with it, they would patch it.
Yeah, well, they probably will fix security essentials, but it's just like, really? The last patch, they broke something? It's like,
cash registers still run XP.
Yeah, oh, ATMs?
ATMs still do.
ATMs still run XP.
A lot of things still run XP. XP, you know, even though everybody says micro, you know, it's dead. No, XP is not going away.
And, you know, I think Microsoft is really counting on that because, you know, like they didn't charge so much that people aren't going to pay it because it's not going to, like, it's probably going to be more cost effective for a lot of places to just pay the $200 a year.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's going to be more than that. Apparently, the price is going to increase every year.
Oh, wow.
I was summarizing the article. If you go into that full Make Use Of article, it's written like something off Make Use Of, which is why I was summarizing it. Where is it? Microsoft's providing support for Windows XP, but it'll cost you. Custom support program cost about $200 per PC for the first year and more every year afterwards. We'll fix rated critical and release patches for these users, while flaws rated important will only be patched if the users pay extra. Problems rated moderate and low will not be patched at all. So, yeah, but I mean, you saw the reports of some of these companies, like the IRS is paying them insane amount of money, and like the entire British government is paying them an insane amount of money. I mean, I'm a little worried that this is going to create a business for software makers of only providing patches if they, if they're paid for it. Yeah, I mean, that's basically how the antivirus industry works, but... You know, what if everybody starts doing this after seeing Microsoft pull it off?
Yeah, that would kind of suck. It's kind of interesting, I think, also, because this is the first time that I recall this being done. Like, do you guys remember switching? My first computers had Windows 98 on them.
Yeah.
Well, not my first computers. I take that back. When I was seriously starting getting into computers and gaming and all that, they had Windows 98 on them. Mm-hmm. And I remember... when XP came out, and I wouldn't fucking touch it for so long because I was, you know, comfortable with X98 and all that, and they quit supporting it. There was no option to get extended support or anything like that on it. This is kind of different. I'm interested in seeing how long they're going to keep it up. I think a lot of these big businesses and stuff have, you know, thousands of computers still running XP, but I think paying this extra support and all that is going to get them off. Make them replace those computers, and then I'm kind of curious to see what the numbers are going to be next year, because I still think this is freaking ridiculous that Windows XP has like a third of the market share or something like that, and
it's just like 30%.
Yeah, you know, they're like, yeah, we aren't going to support that anymore. Like, what the fuck is wrong with you? I haven't gone back and looked. But do you guys know, like, when XP came out and they quit supporting 98? Did it have a third of the market share when they quit supporting it?
No, it didn't. But the thing—that's
what I thought.
What happened?
Right.
Was when they started. You know, of course, they started with 95, and they went 95, 98, and then 98. You know, second edition, and then they went into 2K. So they were hitting that 2 to 3 year release cycle pretty effectively there, and so they would support 98. They supported it long enough that by the time they quit supporting it, almost everybody had gone to 2000 or XP. Now, ME, I don't believe they supported for very long, but that's because they decided it didn't exist and just didn't want to acknowledge it anymore.
That's because it sucked. It was on one of my computers. It sucked.
Yeah, it did. It was a bit of a pain. And, you know, I was joking about the Commodore 64 before, but Sard, I actually did start on a fucking Commodore 64.
Yeah, I know that, and I know yours still works.
Well, it's not the same one. My dad gave my uncle the original one. I have no idea what happened to that thing after he passed. It's long gone. I got a replacement one off eBay because I got nostalgic. And then I made a network card for it, and the network card has more processing power than the freaking computer. Anyways, but. Yeah, I mean, they would support them long enough that by the time they quit supporting it, you know, like, nobody was still using the old one. But install bases were a lot smaller. I mean, think about it.
Yeah.
How many computers were kicking around back in the Windows 3, you know, or the NT 3.5 days?
No, that's a very good point.
I mean, not everybody had one on their desk. You know, and now, you know, of course, 95 and 98... You saw those in businesses and schools, but you could upgrade those machines. Any computer that could run Windows 98 would run Windows 2000. It may not do it very well, but it would do it.
Yeah.
You know, the jump from Windows XP to 7 or 8, there's no guarantee that that's going to work.
Yep.
The hardware requirements really are that different. But The thing is, XP was the primary Microsoft operating system for like 10 years, something like that. Or, I mean, I don't know if you want to count Vista or not, but...
No one counts Vista.
But, you know, that was their flagship business and home OS for, you know, a decade, effectively. Yeah. So, that install base is massive. It's made it into all these different devices. I mean, you know, you think about things like the Redbox. You want to bet a Redbox is running a Windows Embed or a Windows XP behind that touchscreen?
Yeah.
I mean, how many things are running that?
Billboards,
ATMs, yeah, I was just going to say, like how many said, you know? Windows XP error messages have you seen on digital billboards?
Yeah.
Yeah. Dozens. I mean, it's all over the place.
So it existed as the primary OS long enough that it became a standard, and there was no reason to mess with anything else, really. I mean, you know, Linux arguments aside, from a business standpoint, XP worked. You'd grab it, you went with it. And when Microsoft tried to replace it, of course, they tried to replace it with Vista, and everybody just kind of pointed and laughed. Now, they got 7, and they got 7 working, and so modern machines pretty much are running 7. And, of course, gamers are running 7 for DirectX because XP won't load the latest versions of DirectX. But a lot of programs still work on XP. I mean, almost everything still does. So, you know, I guess, yeah, I mean, okay, anyways. I mean, so you think about it, is, you know, what's the better choice here if you still have an XP box kicking around? Do you take it to Linux? Because I'll tell you, a modern Linux like Ubuntu with Unity, it doesn't play as nice on older machines as you might think. It wants some 3D acceleration there.
Yeah, I imagine so. Plus, it's Unity.
Yeah, but I mean, it's trying to use OpenGL to render the desktop.
Yeah.
Which is something Windows 7 does. So, you know, people talk about, oh, you can switch to Linux, you can switch to Ubuntu, you can switch to Slackware, you can and yeah, how many XP users, honestly, think about it, people still using XP, how well do you think they're going to do switching to a Linux?
If it's a GUI,
it depends.
Linux has some very functional GUIs, dude.
Yes, they do. I mean, a GNOME 2 desktop is quite usable. It doesn't take that long to get used to. GNOME 3, on the other hand.
Yeah, no one's running GNOME 2 anymore.
Well, Mate.
Nothing supports it. Well, yeah, other than Mate, but I wouldn't be surprised if that went away as well. But it's just, it's one of those things that completely depends on what they use a computer for. Like, I would never be able to switch any of my family members over to it because they're going to come to me with this random-ass program one day and be like, look what I bought, but for some reason it won't load on my computer. And it's like, well, you know, yeah, you aren't running Windows anymore, that's why. So it's for someone that isn't going to dick with it and is only going to use it for email and web browsing.
That's funny. I have almost the exact same story. I put my sister on Ubuntu. After this was back before Unity. This was back when Ubuntu was still a really nice Linux to use.
Yeah.
And she had gotten a really bad virus on her XP laptop. So I put Ubuntu on there for her because she said she just didn't want to have to deal with that crap anymore. I'm like, okay, here you go. And she used that for, I don't know, like a year and a half? Without really any kind of a problem. She'd occasionally call me up and ask me how to do something on it. But, I mean, most of the time it was nothing. It was just, oh, you know, here. Oh, okay. And that was it. You know, especially because they had most of the menu labels at the time made sense. So you could tell what something was. But, I mean, to my knowledge, she never had to pull up the command line for anything. And she used it for a long time. But the reason we put XP back on her laptop was because she wanted to play The Sims.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course, that wasn't going to happen at the time. Wine wasn't that great yet. But yeah, I mean, you know, Firefox and OpenOffice, and really all she needed was Firefox and OpenOffice, and she was good to go. So
yeah,
but
yeah,
really, what the vast majority of people would ever use. Like, there's really not a lot out there that your average PC user would ever need that is, you know, Windows specific.
Especially today with almost all the major programs having, you know, all your browsers are on all three major platforms. I mean, hell, everything's through the web browser these days. So the only problem is games, really.
Yep.
And so many people are used to Microsoft Office.
That too.
Like, you know, yeah, there's Open Office and Libre Office and all these other ones, but like, and they're very similar, but if you're really used to one thing, it's very hard to make that switch.
Yeah.
And how many web apps are written for XP? Not XP, for
Internet Explorer 6. God.
I saw a big old hoopla about that too, because with XP ending support, that officially ended support for IE6.
Yeah.
A bunch of web devs cried out in joy.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, the answer I keep seeing everywhere is tell them to switch to Linux. And as much as I would love that to be the answer for people who are still on XP, I don't know that that really is. And
honestly,
it might be.
It's as much of an answer as switch to Windows 7.
That's true. That's true.
And if you're looking at it from a cost-benefit analysis, how much cheaper can you run 1,000 computers on Linux as you can run on XP? Or, I'm sorry, Windows 7.
Well, it depends on what Microsoft is charging for a license that day. But, you know, if you are going to go Linux, of course, Ubuntu just dropped the 14.04 release. So, a lot of people are pushing Ubuntu as an XP alternative. Personally, if I was going to put people on a Linux for an alternative to XP, probably Lubuntu would be the one I would go to, because LXDE looks so much like Windows XP. And you could even theme it to look like Windows XP, but I would say that would probably be the one I would put them on. If you wanted to get away from the Ubuntus, oh, what was the one I was playing with? Shoot. I can't remember the distro now. I've played with so many different ones. Haiku! No, not Haiku. fuck. Elementary was the one I was playing with. Its OS looks very much like a Mac, so you can tell them you gave them an upgrade, for people who get into that. But it was actually, I played with it on my netbook, and my netbook was having a little bit of a hard time with all the animations it wanted to do, so something with a slightly better graphics card than a Intel 945, you know, would probably be great with that. But anyways, but the thing I wonder is maybe it's better just to leave the machine running XP. I mean, everybody talks about, oh my God, you're going to be so vulnerable to viruses. But if you think about it, XP probably has the most online information about fixing it in any other operating system.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, a lot of new software might not work with it, but how many sites catalog the old stuff? And, you know, like Madman was saying, their company's advertising that they're going to support their security package for it to keep things working. And I'm sure there'll be unofficial patches and fixes for stuff floating around if you trust such things. It's like, here, guys, I fixed this patch. Why is my machine connecting to China?
Weird. It's supposed to do that. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, I would say, in all seriousness, if you're going to keep a machine on XP, you want to switch out to a modern browser like a Firefox with Adblock and NoScript. Maybe even wrap it in a sandbox. Sandboxy is the one that comes to mind. I've been hoping to find an open source alternative to Sandboxy. I have yet to find one. I also haven't looked recently, so hopefully there is one. But something like some kind of a sandbox would probably be fantastic. And, you know, keep a firewall either on the machine or in front of the machine, preferably in front of the machine with a whitelist and ACLs if you're a business. If you're a home user and you're still running XP, I'd honestly go the Linux route at that point. But, yeah, I mean, you want to harden. There's all kinds of good things you can do to harden it. But if you think about it, it's kind of funny because you have all these people saying, oh, God, XP support is ended. You know, what all do I have to do to protect myself? Well, just everything you should have been doing in the first place anyways. So I'm wondering if here in a year or so, if XP boxes will be the most secure thing out there because they're not getting patched anymore. And so people went nuts to lock them down.
Yeah. I'd like to think that, but I don't know.
Yeah. Hopeful thinking.
That's kind of what I'm going to say, probably.
So I like Cycross's idea in the IRC there. Just get a really good hosts file. Just yeah. block as much crap as you can.
Yeah.
So
yeah. It's all going to depend on how tech oriented the company is. I mean, a small business or something, I don't see anyone doing that, nor do I, depending, you know, if it's a point of sale system or something like that. I don't know. I don't see something like that going to Linux.
Well, okay. Now, truthfully, though, I honestly think at this point, XP, the biggest problems for it virus-wise are going to be drive-by downloads. They're not going to be the network-based crap.
Yeah, because you still have your perimeter out. So, I mean, as long as it's not open,
you know, so,
you know, with no firewall in front of it or no NAT or, you know, whatever in front of it out to the internet, it's still going to be users clicking on phishing attempts or drive-by downloads or...
I've got to address something. Cycross is talking in the IRC about running a Snort on a Raspi, and the Snort box I built at work was a you know, 8-core i7 with like 16 gigs of RAM, and I was pegging the damn thing. So I'm sitting there going, Snort on a Raspi? What? No! But that's also for a very, very large network. I think he's talking about like one or two machines, so maybe.
Right.
it's like, yeah, I've pegged a very nice high-end server with Snort. So you do have to spin up one process per core to do that. But, you know, with pfRing, that's exactly what you have to do to make it make sense, because Snort is not multi-threaded, and I just lost everybody, didn't I?
No comment.
Yeah. Anyways, let's go on to Psycher says I followed you. I should quit reading the IRC when we're trying to do a show. Let's see. Yeah. Let's go into the current events here. First story up is from Ars Technica. On Monday, after 7 months of discussion and planning, the first phase of a two-part audit of TrueCrypt was released. The results, iSEC, the company contracted to review the bootloader and Windows kernel driver for any backdoor or related security issue, concluded that TrueCrypt has no evidence of backdoors or otherwise intentional malicious code in the assessed areas. While the team did find some minor vulnerabilities in the code itself, iSEC labeled them as appearing to be unintentional, introduced as a result of bugs rather than malice, which is not unexpected to see in any code. I love that They're like, yeah, it's got bugs in it. And how many people were getting... I saw posts like, oh, my God, should you use it with these kind of bugs? It's like, yeah, those are in everything, man. It's like, calm the fuck down.
An analysis like this done on it.
Yeah. Since September 2013, a handful of cryptographers have been discussing new problems and alternatives to the popular security application. By February 2014, the Open Crypto Audit Project, a new organization based in North Carolina that seeks formal 501c3 nonprofit status, raised around $80,000 toward the goal of various online funding sites. The results don't panic me, Matthew Green, a John Hopkins cryptography professor who has been one of the people leading this effort, told Ars. I think the quote, quality is not as high as it should be, but on the other hand, nothing terrible is in there, so that's reassuring.
It's an open source project.
Half of it's written by hobbyists. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so what do you expect?
Green said that the second phase is now to perform a detailed crypto review and make sure there's no bug in the encryption. What? TrueCrypt mostly uses standard. Well, no, I was getting ready to say that they, they do Blobfish and SHA and well-known crypto algorithms, but there could easily be bugs in the implementation. But
right.
I was going to say I thought all the crypto they do in TrueCrypt is pretty much proven off-the-shelf math. It wasn't anything they made up themselves. So. I don't know. I don't remember seeing any oddball you know, crypto algorithms in there.
No,
I mean, now I pretty much always use Blowfish with it, so I suppose there could be bugs in their implementation of it, but I don't think there's any problem with the actual crypto they're using.
Yeah, the actual crypto algorithm, which makes sense. Like I said, I mean, that's pretty much everyone's heard of AES 256.
Yeah, yeah. So specifically, the report continued, overall, the source code for both the bootloader and the Windows kernel driver did not meet the expected standards for secure code. Excuse me. This includes issues such as lack of comments, use of insecure or depreciated functions, inconsistent variable types, and so forth. Things consistent with an open source project. Gee, go figure. A more in-depth discussion on the quality issues identified can be found in Appendix B of the... In contrast to the TrueCrypt source code, the online documentation available does a very good job of both describing TrueCrypt functionality and educating users on how to use TrueCrypt correctly. This includes recommendations to enable full disk encryption that protects the system disk to help guard against swap, paging, and hibernation-based data leaks. The team also found a potential weakness in the volume header integrity checks. Currently, integrity is provided using a string true and two CRC32s. The current version of TrueCrypt utilizes XTS2 as the block cipher mode of operation, which lacks protection against modification. However, it is insufficiently malleable to be readily attacked. The integrity protection can be bypassed, but XTX prevents a reliable attack, so it does not currently appear to be an issue. Nonetheless, it is not clear why a cryptographic hash or HMAC was not used instead. Well, that's probably some developer thought. Well, Green also told ours he corresponded with one David Morgan at TrueCrypt.com, who may or may not be a real person.
Nice.
He could have been a robot. We're not sure. One of them lizard people. The software's developers remain mysteriously anonymous to inform them of the plan to do the audit and to share the audit results. The crypto professor said that Morgan acknowledged the volume header weakness, but said that TrueCrypt was only supposed to protect you against certain things and was not to be as foolproof as some may like it. It did not seem extremely important, but I think it's good to know about, Green noted. But I think it's good we didn't find anything super critical. So, in other words, this is this is exactly what we were expecting them to see in this audit of TrueCrypt, which is no backdoors, maybe some bugs in the code, you know, inconsistencies, from open source, but, you know, no backdoors, nothing crazy. So
Right. They're
finding bugs. And the cool part is if they publish the bugs, the guys will fix it.
Well, yeah. It doesn't, that's what I was going to say. Being open source, it doesn't have to be these guys. It could be anyone that sees these bugs now and fixes them and says, you know, we have an, you know, auditing proof, you know, proof of concept code or whatever. Come use this version because we fixed all the bugs in the audit. So
sure.
I mean, even if there was a freaking backdoor in it, it's...
Somebody could fork it and take it out, sure.
Yeah, someone could fork it, take it out. It's open source for a reason. That's one of the good things about open source.
Yeah. All right, next one up is from RT.com. Few will likely find themselves reading the fine print added to the new terms of service issued by Google this week, but the updated version clarifies to customers once and for all that the contents of messages going in and out of Gmail are being scanned. On Monday, the search engine site turned Silicon Valley giant updated the terms of service that its hundreds of millions of Gmail users must agree to in order to use the immensely popular free email service. But while the latest TOS clause doesn't exactly reveal any new practices being performed by Google or conditions that catch its customers by surprise, the company is now being upfront about its controversial practice of skimming content in order to, as they put it, provide users with relevant product features such as customized search results, tailored advertising, and spam and malware detection. When you upload, submit, store, send, or receive content to or through our services, you give Google and those we work with a worldwide license to use, host, store, reproduce, modify, create derivative works, such as those resulting from translations, adaptations, or other changes. We make sure your content works better with our services. Communicate, publish, publicly perform, publicly display, wait a minute, and distribute such content. That's a lawyer covering their ass is what that is. The update clause continues. The right you grant in this license are for limited purposes of operating, promoting, and improving our services and to develop new ones. Google has published a fine print online as well as made a version that compares the latest iOS with its previous terms, last updated in November 11th of 2013. We want our policies to be simple and easy for users to understand, Google said in a statement this week. These changes will give people an even greater clarity and are based on the feedback we received over the last few months. Although Google doesn't elaborate any further in their statement, the feedback that they allude to is likely a federal court case that is centered on complaints stemming from the scanning process in question. Google has previously argued that it scans data sent over its service using fully automated processes that involve no human review of any kind. Now I cut out the part talking about the case. But yeah, Google has been sued by a privacy advocate saying that people who send email to somebody with a Gmail account never agreed to Google's terms of services that their emails would go through Google's content scanning systems.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think we talked about that a couple weeks back or something like that.
We did. We talked about the story when they got sued. But
I believe Google's argument of, but the person you sent it to did, because it doesn't matter if Morps doesn't want me to revealing whatever he tells me. If I reveal it, it's me.
Yeah, and you know, that's a very good point. Like, if I were to send you an actual physical letter, that letter would then be your property to do with what as you please. So it's no longer something I have any rights to.
Good point, too, yeah.
Yeah.
So long as whoever's using Gmail agrees to the terms, then whoever's sending the messages, I don't see as having a valid case.
Yeah.
No, I think people should actually read these terms of service, no matter how wordsome, annoying, and filled with legalese they are, because you should be knowledgeable about what you're using.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. That, you know, I use Gmail for a lot of stuff. I mean, yeah, Google has my email. I know this. I really don't care. It's not that interesting. But if you are concerned about this, you should be aware of it. Which means if you are that concerned about somebody else having your email, run your own email server. Because that's the only way to do it.
Right.
If
you have control over everything.
And be aware of where you're sending email. So if you're sending the super secret crypto to somebody at a Gmail account, you know, you want to wrap that up in, say, a TrueCrypt container and send that to them so Google systems can't get into it. But yeah, you just have to understand that, yeah, Google has robots looking at your email. And I'll be honest, you know the reason I still use Gmail for a lot of stuff? They have great spam filters. I mean, they really do.
It's really good.
I mean, so it's like, okay, so Google gets to see me corresponding with, well, you know, my new employer, for one. so, yeah, Google knows where I work. Whoop-de-fucking-do. So does the IRS. And I'd much rather the IRS not know where I work than Google.
odds are Google knows more about you than your immediate family members do.
What was the story? Target sent somebody a card congratulating them on being pregnant. And it was like
Amazon
their parent
did that.
Oh, it was Amazon. Is that who it was?
Yeah.
And like, you know, it went to the parents' address and the parents didn't know yet or something like that.
Yeah, seriously, Amazon knew the person was pregnant before their parents did. And, you know, it's very interesting how they can build profiles on information that just you wouldn't even dream would, like, you know, just like going out and like buying some extra multivitamins and some other like unrelated things, like buying a larger purse, is enough to like build a profile that matches you in with being pregnant. Like, it probably, like, from that one story, it wasn't even going out and like buying diapers or something like that. It was just some what would seem like unrelated things when you look at them individually. But when you group it all together, it's like, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's a pregnant person who's buying this.
Well, you think your credit card company doesn't do the same profiles?
Oh, well, I'm sure they do.
I mean, hell, a lot of them do it as part of their anti-theft. Because what is it they say if you go buy a pair of tennis shoes and then buy 2 tanks of gas right in succession, like that'll get you flagged for a stolen card because that's like a common activity of people who steal your credit card.
Yeah, but really? To be fair, like that's good security, you know, looking for that sort of thing. That's that's what I would want my credit card to be doing, because it's gonna be, watch out for that sort of thing.
Yep. All right. Let's see. Next one up is from the Inquirer. A bipartisan bill has been introduced in the U.S. Senate with the unlikely but wonderful title, Let Me Google That For You. The bill, sponsored by Senators Tom Colburn and Claire McCaskill, has the purpose to streamline the collection and distribution of government information and proposes that the government prioritize searching for information via the Internet. The present protocol for government research involves an organization called the National Technical Information Service. It's estimated that up to $100 a pop, it's rather It's estimated that at up to $100 a pop, it's a rather expensive way to find information, especially since the NTIS probably uses Google itself. Should the Let Me Google That For You bill become law, it would ensure that the NTIS becomes a historical footnote. A review of the NTIS in 2012 by the Government Accountability Office found that 74% of its work could be achieved with a few mouse clicks, and of those, 95% of the results were free of charge to the end user and therefore the taxpayer. The bill, which says that the NTIS, which was set up in 1950, has been losing an average of $1.3 million per year over the past decade, largely due to the advent of the Internet. During the two readings of the bill, the Senate concluded that no federal agency should use taxpayer dollars to purchase a report from the National Technical Information Service that is available on the Internet for free. The bill has been referred to the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation. With the U.S. Congress having been preoccupied with the NSA, okay, that's just a slug line. Screw that. But, yeah, that's... this is hilarious that the government... This is how bad our government is. They need a fucking law to go through to tell their staff that it's okay to get on Google and find what they need as opposed to requesting a report from some federal agency that's going to cost them at least $100 per report.
My question is, okay, so 74% of the work that you can access through this, you can find on the Internet. What about the other 26%? They shut this down. Does that information just go away? Like,
well, you don't shut it down. You keep it for the information that you can't get otherwise, but you could severely scale the thing back.
Okay, I guess I misunderstood. I took this to mean that they were actually looking at turning off the service because they were saying like the NTIS would be a footnote in history.
It would kind of be a footnote. It'd pretty much just be used. It'd be used to find out government information that hasn't been made public yet.
Yeah, like I'm all for streamlining the service. Like, there's a ton of dinosaurs out there that are just hemorrhaging money. You know, $1.3 million a year. It's not a ton when you're looking at government spending, but you know, I'm sure they could even make it profitable if they just digitized everything.
Well,
had a couple
it's not
of guys
even that.
Sitting in a shack that could do a search occasionally.
I think about okay. We all know that government is glacial when it comes to how fast it gets something done. If you think about how much of that time must be waiting on their staff to get reports from this agency and then understand them, when they could just grab a tablet, grab a fucking iPad, get on Google, find out what they needed, and not to mention, if the government is using the same information sources as everybody else, maybe we'll get government that makes a little bit more sense. I'm dead serious on this. I think one of the reasons we get such fucked up laws is these people live in such a disconnected world from regular life that they don't understand that what they're doing looks fucking stupid.
Yeah.
Good point. Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you look at some of these laws, it's like Obamacare, I like picking on this as a good example. They honestly thought that this was a good thing, passing this massive insurance regulation, setting up federal exchanges to buy health insurance, and mandating that you do so. All these lawmakers thought this was a good thing, and they paraded as, see, we fixed our healthcare system. No, you didn't. You just added another layer of bureaucracy on top of the damn thing, and ran a lot of people out of the field.
But you're not looking at it from the lawmaker's point of view.
That's my point. The lawmakers should have the same point of view as everybody else.
The lawmaker's point of view is to maintain power and control. They're evil that way.
You're not helping me out here, Madman.
Well, I'm just pointing out it is doing exactly what many people who voted for it wanted it to do. They're going to have an increased voter base. Try to repeal Social Security, even though we all know it's bankrupt, and I would get more of a return for my money putting it in an IRA or a mutual fund. Not going to get repealed because lots and lots of old people want to keep it. And they vote for whoever's going to keep it. Same thing with Obamacare now. It doesn't matter that it is driving up the cost of medicine. Most end users don't pay attention to that. That's why the cost of medicine was going up before it was passed. But now, anyone who wants to get rid of it is going to have a challenge staying in office.
Yeah.
Because lots and lots of people like the idea of the government's giving me free shit.
Yeah. Yeah. That's not... Oh, I don't really want to go down that rabbit hole. I just picked that example because that law is really easy to look at the problems with it. But it's also recent. But I know a lot of... You know, honestly, I currently working at a university, I know a lot of people who really like it because they were able to buy health insurance and apparently they weren't able to afford to do so before. So I don't understand that because I figured it would have been cheaper just to go get it ahead of time, but they went through the exchange and they really liked it. So I know some people like it. I don't mean to get political. I just, that law has some obvious problems that anybody should acknowledge. So, you know, healthcare, who should pay for your healthcare argument aside, right? So,
right. Yeah.
Well, one reason they need a law to allow people to use Google is all the privacy laws that they've put out that would prevent them from using open source information. Depending on the type of file you're trying to get, it can be illegal to look it up online for a government agency or even a bank.
But Google dorking is a thing, and it's easy. This, I mean, talk to argue about that. I mean, this concept of it's illegal to look at something boggles my mind.
Yeah, well, it boggles my mind that it's 2014 and we're still having to pay for information. I was kind of thinking of like Aaron Schwartz and his whole thing, downloading all of those PDFs and information from universities that, you know, people would have to pay a subscription, hundreds or thousands of dollars, to just go and search through this database and pull academic papers out and stuff. Why is that shit behind a paywall? It should be.
Well, oh, that's a good point. We actually had a problem recently at work with, because I work at a university, right? Or till the end of the month. And, yeah. So that's why the show's going on hiatus, is that's changing. But, we had one of our library servers get hacked, and that's what they were doing with it, is they were copying Aaron Schwartz. They were trying to pull through all these reports and papers, and, Well, it wasn't so much. Somebody got a password. And it was an account that got popped, and they were just pulling massive amounts of data through it, and it didn't look like anything was going wrong because it was a local IP. It was somebody from the area was doing it, and we got a letter from another university. It said, "Oh my God, what are you guys doing pulling all this information?" So we went off and looked, and that's what was going on. And we got the problem taken care of, but the reason it's behind all these paywalls is because these companies bought the research from the people who did it and published it in their paywall system. They locked it up so they could charge people for it specifically. That's the only reason it's behind a paywall, is somebody locked it up so they could charge people to get access to it.
Yeah.
So... anyways, I'm not sure I should have even talked about that, but you know what? I don't really care. But let's see. Is this my last story? Yeah, this is my last story. This one's from Ars Technica. In response to customer outcry, organizations holding off on deploying the Windows 8.1 update. Now, this is confusing as hell because Microsoft just released Windows 8.1 update. The name of the update is update.
What?
Yes. The name of the instead of 8.11, it's the name of the version is Windows 8.1 update.
Wow.
I
that's
I once that was... yeah. Go ahead, Swolf. Go ahead.
That must have been a really unproductive board meeting that they had when they came up with that name.
Okay, now I once took a file server to a LAN party, and I named the server Elsewhere, because the joke to me was great. Where's your file? Oh, it's off elsewhere. And this doesn't work very well when you're trying to tell somebody that the name of your file server is Elsewhere, because they get really upset with you. It's like the old who's on first joke.
I mean, right.
And anyways, right, so where was I? In response to customer outcry, organizations holding off on deploying the Windows 8.1 update will be able to get security updates for their systems for another 3.5 months, as opposed to the 30 days Microsoft originally promised. When the Windows 8.1 update, designed to improve the mouse and keyboard experience of Windows 8.1, was initially released last week, Microsoft said that it was a mandatory update. Any future security updates starting from next month would require the update to be installed. This was met with frustration, with a frustrated response from IT personnel. Not only did the update cause problems with the Windows Service Update Services deployments, although this was fixed today, it was also of a sufficient scale and size that organizations were partway through deploying Windows 8.1, and they didn't want to switch to the update partway through to the need to retest and revalidate it. God, they're getting bad at this. Somebody get Bill Gates back in Microsoft, because I think at least when he was running the company, they weren't this crazy. Some comments on Microsoft announcement would be that it would be compulsory went so far as to compare it with a service pack. This perception is significant because service packs have a well-established support policy. Generally, there is a 2-year overlap during which Microsoft provides security fixes for both the current service pack level and the previous one. This affords plenty of time to test the update before deploying it. But since this update is not branded a service pack, that policy is not in effect, and Microsoft instead wanted to push it aggressively. Extending the support window to 120 days instead of 30 should provide a little bit respite to those administrators who are unhappy with the forced update while still forcing a much more rapid deployment than would be the case with an actual service pack. However, we expect this kind of thing to be the norm in the future. We know that Microsoft intends to release future Windows Point X updates, such as the one that will introduce a hybrid start menu start screen, and believe that this likely heralds a faster-paced approach to operating system updates in general, as Microsoft strives to keep up with Android, iOS, OS X, and even Chrome OS, which all deliver new end-user functionality on a much more regular cadence than Microsoft has traditionally managed. Given each of these smaller but semi-regular updates throughout the updates the service pack lifecycle would create enormous overheads for Microsoft, overheads that competing platforms don't really have to suffer. Faced with competing pressure to deliver features quickly, provide support, and keep development manageable, something has to give. Ditching service packs with their support commitments is probably the least painful way to go. Windows 8.1 is, from a support perspective, equivalent to a service pack. Microsoft lists it as the latest update to Windows 8. But going forward, we'd expect to see this kind of update to disappear, replaced by a series of smaller mandatory upgrades. So, yeah, Microsoft basically said that if you have Windows 8.1 and you haven't put out this latest Windows 8.1 update, I wish they would have given it a better name. And they didn't want to use the word service pack, right? They clearly did not want to do that, because that implies support, you know, for certain levels. That, yeah, I wish they would have just called it 8.11, because then at least it would be easy to refer to. Because then you don't know if they're talking about general updates or the update, you know, capital letters with quotes around it. it's and even the article is hard to understand because of this nomenclature. So they at least do the I like the Ubuntu thing where they gave it an animal name so you could at least distinguish your versions, or naming it by the date. That worked really well too, actually. So at least you know what you're talking about. But this Windows 8.1 update is, apparently they're not going to patch it if you don't install that update, even though it's kind of a service pack. So I think they're really slimming back. I think they're going to be dropping Vista support soon. I think what they really want to do is get it to where there's one version of Windows, and they probably really want to do the subscription model, like Psychros was saying in the chat room. And, you know, it's the version of Windows, and you're either current or you're not. You know, I don't think they want to keep all these different versions floating around, and they don't want to keep, you know, these support commitments for the old versions floating around. They just, you know, you have the subscription model of Windows, and that's it.
And try and make it like a rolling release.
Though. Right, exactly. And I don't know how the hell you would manage this in a business. A home user, okay, fine. Your machine keeps itself up to date. Who cares, right?
It's one machine, yeah, exactly.
Right. But if you're dealing with a deployed image set of several thousand machines, you know, I deal with 7,000 machines on a regular basis, and they're not all the same. And it's a pain in the ass. And, you know, I can only imagine when you have these silent updates come in and you just kind of have to take them or Windows is, you know, not going to work. Well, what happens when you have, fantastic example. We still have some XP machines floating around the campus I work at that control robots. And by robots, okay. I mean automotive robots. They have them in labs that teach people how to program and control these things, right?
Right.
They can't update these machines past Service Pack 1 because the software quits working. Because the people they bought the software from went out of business like, you know, 10 years ago. And for whatever reason, these patches break it. And they can't update. And, you know, they bought this thing. It's tens of millions of dollars. And that's it. They're stuck on it. And, of course, what we've made them do is unplug these machines from the network because they can't update them. And they're
right,
so
easiest way.
Oh, yeah, they're so damned easy to hack, too. It's like whenever we find we find them plugged back into the network from time to time because it was like somebody wants to check their Facebook while programming the robot, which that's a great idea.
But yeah, that's nice.
Whatever. It's like, you know, BitTorrent. I want to download movies while I program a robot. So you got a fucking laptop, kid. Use that. I mean, whatever. But damn it. My favorite is getting file sharing complaints on machines that are not supposed to be connected to the network. It's just, ooh, that's something with my new job. I'm not going to have to deal with file sharing complaints anymore. You have no idea how happy that makes me. Anyways. I don't know what's going to happen here. I think you're going to end up with the, I don't know, Ubuntu, as much as I rag on them, because I really don't like Unity, Their long-term release model is, you know, Debian does a good job of this too, where they have the stable and testing and SID releases.
Right.
You know, Debian does a good job. I think Red Hat does too, actually, where they're maintaining their various versions, you know, well, years. They've got this right, where they have a version and they maintain that version, and they'll backport security fixes, but that's it. Which is actually really annoying when you're trying to set up a web server in Red Hat 5. Because it's still a really out of date.
So many updates.
Yeah, it's so and it's so out of date on its PHP that, you know, shit doesn't work, and you gotta slipstream in PHP by hand or add sources to it. Then you have the server admins calling you. It's like, what the fuck did you do? It's like I fixed PHP. No, it's like you went outside the package manager. So it's like, no, we can't manage it then. I've had some interesting conversations in my current job.
It sounds like it, yeah.
Really have.
Yeah.
You're handed a virtual machine running Red Hat 5, and you need to put, you know, modern software on it, and it's got PHP version 3 on it.
Did they just want to install something in Redneck or something?
No, you're That's thinking Red Hat Linux version 5. I'm talking Red Hat Enterprise version 5.
Oh, okay. Like... The only reason I ever installed that was because I wanted to see Redneck.
And it's so hard to find it. I mean, I went through their archives trying to find it. I used to have a version of Red Hat Linux 5. I bought it at Staples in a box.
Oh, yeah.
And I still have the book for that thing because that book was awesome for teaching you how to use Linux. I cannot find the disks. I want to find the disks because I wanted to make a screen capture of the Redneck language install. It was hilarious because what it would do, it was a different language pack, you know, obviously for the installer that was all in Redneck. Like, you that there floor matting your hard driver?
Really?
Oh, it was hilarious.
I've not heard of this before.
Oh, yeah. It's great. And, I mean, you know, like, instead of okay or cancel, it's like, yep, nope. I mean, it's... And I can't find the discs. And I found some other discs, like Red Hat 4 and 6, and it's not on them. And I found some archive discs, and they didn't have it. So it was one of those jokes that just, like, it was on one of these released disc sets, and I can't find it. It drives me nuts that I can't find it, because I wanted to make a YouTube video of it, and I haven't seen anybody else who's made a YouTube video of it. But it's, oh, man. I mean, you're just, it's great, because, you know, they've got automotive terms substituted for tech terms.
Yeah, I just found... Can't get that much swap, Junior. Most you can get is 127 megabytes.
Yes, that's it. Where did you find that? Somebody got screenshots of it?
Yeah, I just threw it into Google. I like that, megabytes.
That's it. Yes, megabytes. Yep. Yeah, that's it.
That's hilarious.
And of course, it would just replace it with English when you were done. It would tell Linux to use English, but the installer was in Redneck. And oh, it's great. That's going in the show notes. That is going.
Perfect. A couple more.
Yeah. We're putting those in the show notes. I've been drinking. In case you haven't noticed, I've actually finished off most of this whiskey. About to finish it off.
Nice.
Now. Anyways. Well. Let me play the sound effect while I copy these links into the show notes. All right. For Digital Dojo, I've got two different things. The first thing I've got is a Perl script. It's on packetstormsecurity.com. And this thing is hilarious. It is a Perl script that listens on TCP port 443 and responds with a completely bogus SSL heartbeat. Unless it detects the start of a byte pattern similar to that used in Jared Stafford's demo for CVE-2014-016, the heartbleed bug. You run it as root, so it gets the privileged port because this thing starts listening on 443. It will output the IPs of suspected heartbleed scans to the console, and it rickrolls the scanner in the hex dump.
Is there screenshots of this?
Go read the script. They've got the script posted right there on the page. Nice. Let's find the... hi there. Your scan has been logged. Have no fear. This is for research only. We're never going to give you up. We're never going to let you down.
Nice.
So, let's see. Where's the other... Sometimes the 3C509 driver got to have heavy extra information to work right through, even though it might work fine without. I love this Redneck installer. Oh, I got to get that second link in there. It was a real thing, and I really wish I could find a YouTube video or something of it somewhere.
Yeah.
Oh. Anyways. Yeah, I used to have the discs that had that on there, and I have no idea what I've done with them. Okay. Where was I? So, yeah, Perl script for pretty much last week we talked about the heartbleed bug. I may have drank a little too much. So this is a honeypot for people scanning for that, because at this point you should have patched your server, you should have reissued your certificates, and you should have had all of your users change your passwords. If you haven't done all that in a week, you're terrible. You're a horrible person. Go jump off a bridge. Or, you know, fix your servers. One of the two. I'm kidding about the bridge part. You should use a building. They're taller. That got dark. Damn.
This is what happens when he drinks.
Apparently. So, anyways, so in all seriousness, it's a way for you to log IPs of people looking for the heartbleed scan. Because if they're not coming from one of your network guys who's testing to see if their fixes to the server have worked... You really would like to know about that, because it's somebody who's probably trying to get either your certificates, well, the primes for your certificates, because I thought about this one. There's another variation of the script. You could probably find it if you really look, that will dump out the primes and reverse engineer the excuse me, the keys for the certificates to your SSL. Right. Somebody's actually made one that'll sit there and request like a million times. So the thing ends up using up like 46 gigs of space.
Well, you're memory mapping the whole entire server. Pretty
well,
much,
you're
right?
Probably more than that at that point, but it's looking for the actual keys. And if it can pull the primes, it will figure out your actual SSL key to the server and dump it out. And I didn't post that one because that is truly malicious. There is no good reason to run that thing. Unless you just, you know, really don't like a website or have the bandwidth to spare or the disk space. Because I'm sure there's a lot of other stuff in that disk space. Did I talk about what I did with the Honeybleed bug last week?
You said you were testing it and had found some interesting stuff with it.
Fuck it. I popped our Barracuda message archiver with it. I got the damned admin credentials with the thing.
Yeah, so you did mention that. I wasn't sure if it was on the show. It might have been afterwards, or I think it was before. But so they were just plain text in memory, huh?
Yeah, in memory, yeah.
Huh. Wow.
But yeah, we got the admin credentials, got in the damn thing. That was great fun. It was really fun because we went up to the email admin, and it's like, yeah, you know, this your server has this Heartbleed vulnerability. Oh yeah, we're waiting on Barracuda to issue a patch. Well, you really need to change the admin password. Oh well, we got some people who aren't. Okay, somebody could have used this bug to get into the thing, so you really need to change the passwords. Yeah, you know, but we've got some staff that knows that password, and they're not going to be very happy with us if we go changing it because they've got it, you know, they've got it memorized. Okay, Morp's got into the damn box. You need to change your password now. That's actually how that conversation went. Well, with the exception of the screen name. But anyways. So, yeah. If you haven't fixed Heartbleed in your environment yet, do that now. I'm not kidding. Stop what you're doing. Go fix it now. Because they can get your SSL certs, they can get your users' accounts, they can get session information. It's not good. Second thing I have for Digital Dojo is a little abstract. It's at technology.nasa.gov. The NASA Technology Transfer Protocol contains data from 10 NASA field centers and headquarters, enabling industry and the general public to find out information about technology opportunities, licensing opportunities, and past success stories. NASA has a very large code repository for software that they've developed. And if you look on the right of the website, there's actually a PDF software catalog. And a lot of their software is now open source. So you can go in this technology.nasa.gov. And if you know the serial number for the project, you can get the code for a lot of it. And then you need to get the catalog to see what you're looking for. Most of the code is probably not going to be terribly useful to you as is, but using it as a basis for other projects, I guarantee there's a lot of information in there you could use as the basis for other projects. I was thinking it'd be a lot of fun to go get some of their projections for various orbits and launch, and it's got a lot of the math for doing right. rockets in there. And I'm thinking if you're writing games, getting the actual math right would be cool. And the code is there for doing it. So whereas, you know, you might have to reuse their code or re-engineer it a little bit to do whatever you're doing. I mean, that's, you think about it, you look at the code they were using to run some of their systems, that's got to be highly educational.
Right.
Yeah, especially if you're into coding. So,
what you're saying is someone needs to call up the devs for Kerbal Space Program and give them this link.
Be like, hey guys, double check your work.
Yeah.
So, actually, my understanding was Kerbal got it pretty close. So, all of you are playing that game.
Yeah. I don't know.
Well, how does it feel? It's, you know, because that's more important than technical accuracy.
Kerbal Space Program. I've learned more about orbital dynamics from that game than I have from any of like the thousands of hours of like space documentaries I've watched. like it's a good, very solid, somewhat realistic game. Like they've simplified things down to make things easier. Because if they made it 100% realistic, you'd never get off the planet, because we aren't rocket scientists. But
what, you never played with model rockets when you were a kid?
Well, yeah, but it's not the same.
They made it into orbit.
It's pretty damn realistic, I gotta say.
So, but yeah, there's a lot of code there. So if you're looking for something to pick apart and maybe reuse in a game engine, or I don't know, I think I saw NASA's information request systems in there. So if you're writing something a little bit more mundane, you might look and see if they've got a good chunk of code you can borrow in there. So, yeah, it's just a big code repository with all kinds of stuff in it. But that's
pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth digging through if you do this kind of stuff. So, anyways, listen to the stream. We're always working on it. Sard's going to be taking over main operations for the next few months for me. Pure Decking every Thursday. Well, it's going on hiatus. My template is not accurate here. I don't know what the... Have we started up Shoot the Noise again, Sard? Suave, do you know?
I don't think so.
Okay, so I don't know what's going on with Shoot the Noise. Missing Dialogues on Tuesdays. Galaxy 15 Radio site, the Twitter handle, the feedback form. The sim is no longer running. That machine died. The feedback form, the subreddit, and, of course, I believe Big Brother is still accepting TCP IP via Carrier Pigeon. That's also a major source of where he gets his food. So I do that joke every week, and it never gets old.
No.
So, yeah. And he's eating the pigeons, in case anybody's wondering.
Pigeons are delicious, if anyone's wondering.
I don't even want to know how you know that. The obvious answer is you ate a pigeon. I'm just curious as to what led to this.
It was wrapped in bacon and tossed on a grill. How do you not eat that?
Well, if it's wrapped in bacon, I mean, you know.
And tossed on a grill. You forgot. It was also tossed on a grill.
Not laid with a spatula, not set with a fork. Tossed.
Tossed.
Thrown at the fucking grill.
It was arched nicely and landed perfectly. Wrapped in bacon on a grill.
I'm going to hit play on this music before we find out what other horrifying things Madman's eaten.
User disconnected from your channel.
God, I just realized how much more bourbon's going to cost me where I'm living now.
Oh, really?
Well, I'm like right next to where they make it, so it's cheap. We're talking over the music.
Yeah. Oops.
Your poor liver.
I actually took your advice and was taking milk thistle there for a while. I finished out the bottle, so.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm currently on my fourth bottle.
Ah!
Well, I've been taking it for like 2 or 3 months now, close to 3 months now, and I'm doing a little bit higher than the recommended dose because I'm a big bastard.
All right, switches back to the soundboard so I can play the Pac-Man Dies. And I apologize for taking the hiatus, guys, but you know what I mean? I mean, there's only so much you can do,
yeah.
Right?
Absolutely, yeah, totally.
So here we go.